Good morning, everybody, and congratulations for making it at 9 o'clock on a fairly gloomy Monday morning. Ons praat ongelukkig in die taal van die veroveraar vanweer die feit dat ons 'n gas uit die buitenland het wat wie se Afrikaans 'n bietjie verroes is. So if you'll excuse me, I'll carry on in English exclusively from here. The pattern generally is my colleagues and I have agreed that we will do about half an hour from the stage here, then 20 minutes for questions and comments and the like. At that stage, I will remind you, but at this stage already, please remember that there'll be a roving microphone. Wait for the microphone, otherwise other participants cannot hear your question and the answer is quite irrelevant then. And we'll have a final wrap-up session at the end. To kick off then, why are we all here? Why have you been energetic enough to come at this time of a Monday morning? I believe we're all concerned, we're all worried, we're all profoundly disturbed by many features of our public life, more particularly in relation to the media and to press freedom, to its function in exposing, pursuing, indicting corruption, criminality on the part of the powerful. I think we're all also, particularly those of us who are interested in the media, we're worried about the growth of fake news, false news, cheap news, and at the same time the descent, the decline of legitimate news. Good newspapers, good news publications, particularly in the print area, that have seen a disappearance of many good publications, a decline in the ranks of good journalists. And so it is a singular and appropriate occasion to have two of the icons of the journalistic profession, certainly two of the brightest lights on the African continent. Adrian, I think we all know, it needs very little introduction. I will ask him in a moment to do a little bit of a self-introduction, but at this stage we know him as a fearless persecutor of evil, an investigative journalist who has followed the trails from way back with Bosasa 10, 15 years ago. Ultimately, the prize is there. Bosasa has been exposed for the evil plot that it was. Jackie Salibi, Zuma, I know three books you've written, Adrian. Are there more than that?
Judge, they... No, that's correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll get to them in a second. And then, of course, our guest from Angola. When first I read the name, 10, 12 years ago? Yes. Rafael Marques, if I could pronounce it that
correct.
Way. One of those people that makes one proud to be a human being. Somebody who showed courage, fearless, clearness of vision, notwithstanding the goons and the thugs and the bullying and the torture and the imprisonment. A fighter for human rights, for the dignity of human beings, for the protection of the weak against the powerful. Who fought the Dos Santos regime through the medium of the media, and to some extent, to some significant extent, played a role in its amelioration of its regime over many years. We will be hearing more from him in a moment. Both of them at the moment have reached the age of discretion, and somehow they haven't acquired the discretion that they should. They're still fighters for freedom. They're still fighters for the truth they're still fighters for the protection of the little guy, the protection of the rule of law, the protection of human rights. Let me start off then, after that peroration, with a question first to you, Rafael. What's a nice guy like you doing in a joint like this? What bugs you? Why can't you go home and sit on the veranda and have a beer? What bites you? What drives you?
Actually,
and what got you in it in the first place?
Actually, one of the main reasons of not giving up is that every single day when one says, oh, I'll have a beer, someone else comes up and says, well, I have this problem. And then you think, well, let me just take this one and then go have my beer. And then it comes the next one and the next one. So you just keep going because in the end, that's what really makes, in this case, makes me what I am today. It's the ability to respond to those demands by people who otherwise would not have their voices heard and their issues addressed. But sometimes it gets quite depressing because just days ago I received a message from a colleague in the Far East saying, well, I'm sick and my family is sick and I have no money, but there are these human rights abuses taking place. How do you want to go about them? And I said, well, first let's take care of your family. But so it becomes part of our nature to address these issues. And what got me in the first place, I wanted to be a poet. I wanted to write. And as I got my first job as a journalist, I just realized that I could not be, could not distance myself from the reality of the country. And I had to address some of the abuses taking place. And I started doing that. And once you start it, it's very difficult to just quit.
As a lawyer, I'm not prepared to take evasive answers. I don't think you've answered us at all. What got you going in the first place? Or why was... We all get angry about social injustices, but why do you persist? What do you think is the fire in your belly?
Let me give you an example. Once I exposed a member of parliament for corruption, and then he called me up and offered me crates of beer and fish. And at the time, I didn't drink, and I still don't drink beer with gluten. And I was very angry that he was offering me fish when I'm a vegetarian. So
okay.
Had he offered me something else, probably I'd have changed my mind.
Well, let's leave it there for the moment and pretend we believe you.
But it was a time of great economic crisis in Angola, and it was difficult to have access to... we had a time in Angola where people could travel around the world by selling... canned beer, you know. That's how expensive canned beer was in Angola. So what he was offering me actually was a way of going around the world by selling the crates of beer that he was offering me. And by refusing, he got very angry. And from that moment on, I thought, well, I might as well take them because what they're offering me is not right. And there's so much injustice out there, and why would I settle for beer and fish?
Adrian, you.
Well, let me first declare, Judge, that I do drink beer. and I sometimes drink beer with sources who give me stories as well, because they often like to drink beer at places like the Spur, specifically. I don't know. This is a very difficult question. I'm still trying to figure out why I ended up in this profession. And it's one of the hardest questions. You know, sometimes when people get asked, why did you become a lawyer or a doctor? They have some beautiful story about their father was a doctor. Or, you know, for me, there was never a choice. I cannot think of a time in my life, even as a child, where I wasn't extremely curious, wanted to find out what exactly was happening, whether it was in our own household as a family, whether it was at our school when teachers were doing funny things, or then later on in my life, Bosasa and Jacob Zuma. So I have an insatiable appetite to find out what really happened. What are people hiding from us? What is the truth? I think it's probably coupled. Well, let me start by saying that I grew up in a house of civil servants, and my parents were both teachers. My one grandfather was a policeman, and the other one was a duomini, a priest. And I figured out through the years that a journalist is a combination of those things. We want to find out what the truth is and then tell everyone, like the duomini, you know. So I think there's a bit of that also in my own background. Is, you know, I didn't become a civil servant, but in a way I still feel that obligation to serve and to serve the public through my work, coupled with a serious bout of naivety.
Naivety.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I grew up. I never went to a court in my entire childhood. I didn't know what the court looked like on the inside. I was very lucky and privileged to grow up in a family in a house that didn't become involved in legal disputes. So the first time I went to a courthouse, I was at the age of 19 as a student, where I forced myself, and I was so curious I couldn't stop myself from actually going to the Cape Town High Court one day, and was just completely fascinated and shocked by this world of crime, this world of people who gets in conflict with the crime, with the law. And then starting out as a crime reporter at Beeld newspaper in Johannesburg, following the police and just getting into this world of policemen and prosecutors who live and breathe justice. The bug bit me. Sitting through the Shabir Sheikh trial, seeing how a corrupt politician and a corrupt businessman can deprive an entire province of resources and ultimately to the detriment of the poor. That got the fire going in my belly. But it definitely, I'm still shocked every time I find out these things. I'm not at the point where I'm ready to say, oh, well, everyone is just corrupt, everything is just bad, and we must just make peace with it. And I think that's what part of what keeps me going is I have very high expectations of the human race and of people in general. And I'm often disappointed.
I think what neither of you has said, I can say on behalf of the three of us, that it's fun. Hmm. It's fun to pursue the truth when people are trying to hide it.
Yes.
There's no greater joy than smelling the fox and getting through the undergrowth and eventually finding it, nailing it, notwithstanding the efforts. Am I speaking on your behalf? Do you enjoy it?
Absolutely. Recently, I went to interview a very corrupt and senior official who for the first time accepted to speak to me. And I found him shaking. And this gentleman had really persecuted me and prosecuted me for years. And I just thought, how fun it is now that he's shaking. And you know. But the point is also to see how what we do has an impact on people's lives. And I grew up in the war. And that was one of the reasons why I said, well, I have to do also my part in it to have a better society, because I knew how war was being used for illicit enrichment for many, and how the youth was paying a huge price by being thrown into a war. No one understood why it kept going and how resources were used in that. So that's why one of my focus was on diamonds, because how it fueled conflict, and how also people in the richest parts of the country were the most deprived of resources. And I could not understand, and to date, I cannot understand why, where there are natural resources in abundance, people are the poorest and the one who suffer most, the most serious human rights abuses. And just this morning, I was not laughing because it's a tragic piece of news. One of the individuals who most benefited from the diamond trade in Angola and all the smuggling and all the wrong things that happened there died when he tried to enlarge his penis in Paris 2 or 3 days ago. And I thought, why would this man be part of wrecking a country so that at 65 he could enlarge his... I could not... But there is this aspect of our work that really is quite important in a way that we can have an impact on how people live by exposing the truth, by fighting for it, by fighting for justice, but also how fun it is in uncovering that truth and essentially just realize how we would be better off if we were the police officers and the judges to lock them all up.
In fact, your book on the Blood Diamonds was really when you hit the big time for the first time, isn't it? That gave you an international reputation and led to the many international awards and recognitions that you have as a journalist.
It gave me a great reputation, but also gave me legal cases in Portugal and in Angola. And in 2015, I went on trial. And up against me were 9 of the most powerful generals in the country. So as I sat there in the courtroom, what was interesting, and let me just share quickly this experience. And there was this massive security around the courthouse. And my sister went to see the trial, and then I saw the police officer in charge of the security, the courthouse, running away when he saw my sister. And I said, why is he running away from my sister? He's supposed to check the situation. His son was the one taking my sister to the courthouse. And he was running from the son, not from my sister. And then as I walked into the courtroom, the security, the police officers, they were asking me for copies of the book. And so there was a trade going on, a sort of black market, you know, going on in the courtroom with the copies of the books I had taken. And then as one general passed, entered the room, his bodyguard said, you know, well done, these guys deserve it, you know, go after them. I said, but I'm the one on trial. So at that moment, I just thought, this is really sweet, because I could not think that there were 9 generals there out there against me. And days before, they had approached me to negotiate, to engage in a dialogue. And I went by myself. And one of them said, well, we're generals. Why are you here alone? I said, well, because I wrote the book by myself. So that's the whole thing. Who should I bring? But the end of the story is that some of them are my friends now. And we go around and we try to address issues together rather than fighting against one another. And the reason why also we became friends is because one of them said, look, we're generals, but we're not all equal, all evil. And you know among us who the evil ones are. So let us just settle the case and then work towards our common goal, which is to fix the country. And I yielded to that advice, and I got convicted anyway, but not for what took me to trial. The judge convicted me of something else that was not on the books. But then I was let go, and later the president passed an amnesty so that the case would die with an amnesty. But that's basically the story.
You weren't alone, were you?
No.
You had truth and justice on your side.
Absolutely. And the moment I saw the reaction of the police officers, the people in the courthouse, and everyone, I said, you know, I've done the right thing. And if I have to go back, to come back to this court, I'll be very happy. And I was back at the court the following my trial, the other trial, the last one just ended June last year. And for the first time, I was acquitted. But then the judge said clearly, I never want to see you again in this courthouse.
And you
You're too much of a trouble.
And you agreed with him.
I agreed, but I don't think I will stay away for that long.
Long be that so. Adrian Bosasa, when did you first smell the rat there? And what do you feel today?
I'm absolutely astonished that, Judge, 13 years after I received my first tip-off, everybody now knows the name. It took 13 years. They say the wheels of justice turn very slow and grind, or the, you know, grind very fine. And I've seen this in practice. I couldn't believe it took so long. So it was 2006. I was working at Beeld, the Afrikaans newspaper in Johannesburg. And my colleague Karine du Plessis was in Parliament. She was covering the Correctional Services Portfolio Committee. And she picked up from some of the parliamentarians, like Dennis Bloom, who also gave evidence to the Zondo Commission, that there was this one company coming through getting all the tenders. And in a way, privatizing the prison's functions that prisoners and prison officials used to perform previously, like cooking food and et cetera, providing security. And this company was called Bosasa. I had no idea who Bosasa was. I had no idea who the Watson brothers were. And that's where my journey started, starting in a very basic way of doing company searches, finding out who this company was, making links with the then Commissioner of Correctional Services.
Was that Mtee?
Linda Mtee, yes. And making these very interesting connections between struggle politics and then post-apartheid business. Which is fascinating. Again, now with what's coming out in the Zondo Commission, you can see this schism and this massive conflict and even disillusionment that's infiltrated the ANC now and it's kind of led to this kind of two ANCs we see today of people saying we have to clean up, but in a way we have to clean up ourselves. So it's this massive conflict that lies ahead. But yes, so the Bosasa story over years and started speaking to prison warders, started speaking to business people inside the company. I mean, what made Bosasa so unique was they also had this religious cult, which I'm going to write about in my book, on this topic. It was run like a cult. Like they literally had to be there at 6 a.m. in the morning to pray with Gavin Watson, the CEO, and had to confess their sins, read from the Bible, and then literally they would leave that room to go and cook the tenders in the room next door. So this amazing ability also of humans, and that, I guess that's the fun part you spoke about, just to see this stuff and hear these stories and ask someone, but how did you do this? How did you bring these two things in your mind? You know, how do you pretend to be a Christian and a religious person and then go and commit corruption, which must surely be against your religion. Anyway, this is a fascinating story.
Guys, once again, quite apart from the fun of it, the humor of it at times, the amusement, the sense of humor that you've got to maintain, and of course the absence of judgmentalism. You've got to deal with people whom ordinarily you would not like to deal with.
Yeah.
You would have to be make real friends of people who are sources or potential allies. As you said, Raphael, the generals, one cannot afford to be holier than thou. One must come to terms with the reality that the bad guys are going to be necessary to get rid of the other bad guys.
Absolutely. And actually, I was quite conservative about it until I was thrown in prison. And in this cell with hardened criminals that were supposed to rough me up. And the way they organized around me, they said, well, because everyone is talking about you on the radio, you are our ticket out of here. And so they organized us criminals to protect me so that I could do my bidding as the man of justice. And at the time, I had nothing to do with human rights, nor I was interested about it. But what was important to me, the lesson that I learned, that I became much more aware of the human rights abuses through the eyes of the criminals themselves, who said, well, these are the crimes we committed, and these are the crimes those representing the state are committing here in jail and elsewhere, and how even police officers used criminals to commit crimes. And then these individuals will leave jail at midnight commit their crimes and return to sleep in jail. So they would never find, no one would ever look for criminals in jail, you see. So you learn quite a lot, but also about human interactions. And when I left prison, some of them were actually released and some reformed. And one also offered me a pig, which was quite... I have this thing of getting animals for offers.
For a vegetarian, a pig, I suppose.
I've never been offered a cow or anything.
A goat. Now I have a pet goat that was given to me during Christmas from someone I also helped. But I kept the goat still there at my house. But the important thing is that we really cannot be judgmental. And we have to deal with people as they come along. And when they say, well, I want to play a different role, we just listen to it with a pinch of salt, of course, but to ensure that some good can come out of it. And I've been engaging with all sorts of really dodgy people. And the more I engage with many of them, the more I understand also how some need to have just basically, like days ago, just to this story, a senior police officer came and said, well, I want to denounce a case of corruption. I said, fine, denounce it. And then he said, well, myself and some friends went to get a bank loan of millions of dollars. And I said, well, I wanted to ask him, how did you as a senior police officer went to ask for a bank loan and you're a shareholder of a private company? But then I thought, if I ask that question, I will not get the full story. I said, so go ahead, tell me. And then he explained everything. And then I said, okay, I noted down. Then I went to ask the other people, the other partners. And they said, how come he is exposing us when he violated the law as well? Because he's a senior police officer and he could not be a shareholder and the managing partner of the company. Then in the end, I asked him that question when I had the full story. And he said, thinking about that, can you hold on the story while I check the law? I said, okay, I'll hold on to it for the little time.
It is very interesting, yes, to see these to see people checking their morality or their moral base while you interview, yes, them or while they speak. So I don't know how many of you have watched the Angela Agritzi's evidence before the Zondo Commission, but there was a classic moment that illustrates this when he was talking about this gentleman called Siupela, who was basically driving around the cash for Bosasa to the politicians and allegedly senior prosecutors in the NPA. This guy was the one who had to deliver the cash. So Agritzi firstly gave evidence about how they had this, let's call him the bag man, who had to drive around the cash to bribe the officials. And then he was asked by Paul Pretorius, the leader of evidence, but how do you know that he actually delivered the cash? And his answer was, well, he was a very upstanding person with good morals and integrity. You know? These things are not set in stone. There's no black and white. I also found it very difficult. I found it very hard, especially when I was younger, to sit with the so-called bad guys, because you want to. It's easy to deal with the prosecutors and the whistleblowers, who are doing it for the right reasons. But sometimes whistleblowers are also the bad guys because they want to expose someone who they think are badder than them. So now you have to figure out who's the real enemy, and the enemy's enemy is your friend more. So you have to now make all these calculations and sometimes not turn a blind eye, but prioritize the stories you do and prioritize the information that you publish in order to get to the biggest story. Jackie Selebe being a case in point, he was a police commissioner, and till this day there are people, senior people in the state and civil service and politicians who believe that Agliotti, the capo or the head of the mafia, should have actually gone to prison, not Jackie Selebe. And it's an interesting almost moral discussion, because you need the one to take the other one down. The state probably couldn't have convicted Celebi without Agliotti as a state witness. So then you had to make this, Harry Null and his team had to make this trade-off. Who is the biggest? Who is the baddest? Who is the biggest danger to society? On that one, I agreed with the state. I do think a corrupt police chief is probably as bad as it got. Well, until we had a corrupt president. But I mean, a corrupt police chief is pretty bad. You know, there's like the guy who must police crime is a criminal. I mean, that's pretty kind of hardcore bad, you know. And he was also the head of Interpol, of course, at the time.
Yes.
So, but it is, it takes you into a gray arena of what's the worst of the worst and who's the not so bad criminal, who's the, you know, who's a bigger criminal, and it's not easy.
You know, our topic, our overarching topic is in investigative journalism, and human rights and the rule of law, the freedom of the media and its importance in the protection of our individual rights. It's a long road, isn't it? The goal, the success, the actual reward is often a very, very long way down the road, and you're not sure that that light at the end of the tunnel is indeed the end of the tunnel and not the train coming towards you. Why the persistence? How does one do that? You've got to keep going. What is it that keeps you going, that makes you dogged and determined?
I think it's that very idea of justice at the end of the road. And I always say it's a way also of finding peace with oneself. Because living in a place where you see so much injustice, bringing some sense of accountability makes one find also peace. That's my personal experience. And the way also, for instance, to give you an example, I used to be called crazy in Angola and suffered all sorts of indignities for exposing corruption. Now I see the very same officials I've been exposing for years, some of them being persecuted now under the new president, and screaming for the rule of law.
Yes.
Then that's when you say, how sweet. Now you understand what the rule of law is, that you're facing you know, justice. So, and also it's that element being an African. And the question is like, why do people have to be so miserable when we have so many riches, you know? See children that do not go to school because there are no schools, there is no food. You look at Luanda, the contrasts between the high rises and the places with no basic sanitation, and then you say, where do all this money go to? I'm just actually, I spent before coming here and I almost missed the time. I was writing on this story about a former minister who swindled over $270 million out of the central bank and exchanged that money in the informal market to make more money and stashed it all away in the British Virgin Islands. And then you think, how many schools, you know, hospitals, infrastructures, that education that would have benefited the country, and for what? So that this man can say, I'm a multimillionaire, and without working, without doing really anything that contributes to the economy. So that really enrages me, and that's when you also see, well, I'm not going to let these guys off the hook. And sometimes you have those considerations that you have to see what your priorities are. But you just come to that point, you say, well, even if I have to stay up until 2, 3 in the morning, I will make sure I get this story out.
I agree with the sense of anger. You have to physically get angry at seeing injustice.
So, more than anger, outrage.
Outrage. So every time, and I mean, this is no comparison to some of the stuff you've gone through, but every time I used to arrive at our Tambo airport and I saw the Bosasa security guards for the past 15 years, I was outraged. Because here was this company still making money, you know, when I saw a Bosasa truck driving past me on the road. I think I would like just to add two more things. The first is that the absolute satisfaction one gets, and I don't know if you can remember, Rafael, but I can remember the very first story where I literally realized that my writing, just the effort that I put into a normal day's work, had actually led to a change for not only a family but a community. So just quickly, it was a courtroom in north of Pretoria, in the old Garankuwa, where a young girl of 4 had to testify against her uncle who had raped her. And I was a young crime reporter. Random call came in that day. I didn't have a story to do, and it was the mother asking for us to please come and help her because this uncle has been acquitted, but there wasn't the proper facility in the courtroom where the girl could testify from. The CCTV was broken. She had to stand in front of this man who raped her and give evidence. That outraged me, and I drove to the courtroom. I spoke to the prosecutor, the Department of Justice, etc. The courthouse was fixed. The case was reopened, and the guy was subsequently convicted. So just that satisfaction, it never leaves you. It never, never leaves you. And that feeling has stayed with me my whole life. I'm getting goosebumps as I sit here because I still remember that feeling. And that has inspired me throughout the rest of my career into probably much bigger investigations. And the second part, Rafael, is those people who trust you to tell their story. So the moment I started investigating Bosasa, for example, I had this whole group of people who started phoning me, who became acquaintances and sometimes even, I won't say friends, but friendly, you know. People, you started to meet their families when you went to their houses to pick up documents, you know. They had lots to lose. They were low-ranking officials in the company or in the government. And these people absolutely trust you with their lives. And you cannot fail them. How can I fail them? How can I let go of this? I don't know if you want to call it Calvinism or whatever may be the case.
I was going to ask you
probably a bit of guilt and Calvinism, but I can't let go. I struggle, especially a case like that when you just realize your gut tells you, you smell the blood, there's something bigger here. And I don't believe we have even seen the end of the Bosasa case. I think there's much more to come. I'm just going to keep going. So there are some of these cases that you stick to, and then obviously, sadly, there's a lot of cases you can't get to. On an almost daily basis, we get people phoning into our office from a municipality in Limpopo where they suspect a road tender was corruptly awarded for R1 million or R5 million. I don't have the time or the expertise or the time or the resources or the staff at this moment to investigate that kind of story. Unfortunately, corruption is so big in our country now that even R100 million isn't seen as big money anymore. It must now be a R1 billion contract before you can even investigate it. So that is the sad part of it as well.
Guys, we're having fun here. I promised the audience a fair opportunity to participate. Have we any questions or comments at this stage? Just put up your hand, please. Wait for the microphone to come to you. Introduce yourself and let us have it. Nary a hand. Over there at the right.
Okay, thank you. I hope you like my work. I'd like to ask Rafael about a notorious lady, I think, called Isabel dos Santos and Sol Angol, something like that. What's happened to her and what is she doing?
Good. Isabel dos Santos is the daughter of the former president dos Santos, who ruled Angola for 38 years. and she is Africa's richest woman, so it's no hard guess how she became the richest woman in Africa. And in 2016, her father appointed her to head Angola's national oil company, Sonangol. And then the new president who succeeded her father from the same party dismissed her from running the company. Now there is a legal case against her, and she has not responded to two of the prosecutor's notices, because after she was dismissed, she transferred over $38 million from the national oil company to her own private companies. After the dismissal, so she still acted as if she was the CEO and took the money away from the company, and she has to answer for that. What is interesting about Isabel dos Santos is that she knows how to speak to the international media, and there is a certain glamour about her, and she mingles with Hollywood, and people really give her an easy pass. She's a thief, and she should be held accountable for the wrongs she's done, like this man who died trying to have a surgery to fix his manhood, he thought so, was her partner in crime in the diamond sector, you know. And the violence, the unspeakable violence in the diamond areas against informal miners, so that these people could live well and beyond their means, to me is just unacceptable. And each time she speaks to the international media and tries to put on this face on how she was a hard worker, I just feel like puking. She really needs to be held to account. That's basically what's happening.
Right at the back.
To the entire panel, I am a history scholar. I teach history at high school. So that is the way I see and look through things. And what I see, what I call the sad story of Africa in general, is the fact that the whole idea that I have is that the corruption we experience is a leftover of colonialism. But it seems that these governments cannot get away from these corruption, because most of the resources in countries are used to keep people in power. Political systems are based on not most times what is good for the people, but how do I keep myself as a dictator or a leader in power? And of course, then the result is that the immense suffering of Africans and the immense economical debt that economical problems that we have, which is ironic because Africa in itself is extremely rich in resources, extremely rich in people. Yet I think we have the potential in Africa to become better than or on the same par economically as any other of the like the United States or Europe, but we cannot break this curse of these strongman politics. So my question is, is there enough political will in Africa to reach that point where we can hold people account like these people you just talking about? And even in South Africa, I see this thing that people who are clearly committing corruptible and felonies are kept in their positions. Whereas you see in other governments, even if there is a hint of corruption, someone is forced to resign. Why does the political will not exist to really treat this sickness of corruption in Africa and in South Africa in general? That's my question.
Thank you for that very fundamental question. Would either of you wish to kick off? I have some thoughts, but they're here to listen to you, not to me.
My experience is in covering this is limited to South Africa, and I would just say that I think we are lucky in a sense that throughout this period of state capture, that we have experienced over the past decade, our judiciary and our media stood strong, which I'm not always sure my colleague on the left can say about what happened in Angola. So I think the fact that we had strong courts and judges and a strong independent media that was able to investigate and expose, for example, the attempts by former President Zuma and the Gupta family to close a nuclear deal with Russia, which would have set us down a path of some of the things you've just mentioned, because you need uranium to power a nuclear power station, and you need a lot of money, and would have indebted us for ages and centuries to come. So I think there is light in the tunnel in that sense, in the sense of cleaning up on this side. I'm thankful for the fact that I can do my job without fear of being imprisoned. We can't take that for granted. The press freedom we have in South Africa, protected by our wonderful constitution, that we must protect with our lives. But yes, absolutely. You're of course correct in I think diagnosing the fact that for centuries families and elites have benefited from Africa's minerals, and it's just the faces that's changed throughout the years. But it's still elites trying their best to stay in control of those minerals. In a South African context, we have to regulate it. Our mining industry is basically in its dying days. There's not a lot of investment coming through. People are packing up, selling, which I guess for the economy is not a great thing, but maybe for our long-term future is.
Yeah. I think, and I agree with Adrian, one of the biggest issues has to do with the lack of proper state institutions, functioning state institutions. That's what makes it easier for the capture of states in Africa. And once states are captured, the world will recognize those who call themselves presidents and ruling parties. And they will only deal and do business with those. That's where the biggest problem is. So the thief who calls himself president is the one who has international legitimacy. And that's what's also fundamentally wrong and needs to be changed. But what is most important to me is that for the number of bad guys that are out there ruling these countries, there has to be an equal or even a greater number of good guys challenging them. No matter the cost. And in many countries, you find people doing that, and many getting killed and many getting harassed because there are no institutions to protect them. But it's a struggle that we need to really face head-on if we are to ensure that countries like Angola have a fresh start. And the whole idea that corruption is something we've inherited from colonialism, to me, doesn't sound right, because there are many things we have inherited as well, which are good things, that we have not been focusing on. Like the few, to give an example, in Angola, when the Portuguese left, there were many infrastructures in place. And the reason why we had a civil war was because we could not agree as Angolans on how we should run the country in an inclusive manner. So, and then if someone influenced us to do that, it's still our main fault that we could not understand, you know, the basics of doing better for the people, because of personal greed. So I think it's important also that in some countries the political structures get revisited, the way elections are held, the political parties are formed, so that there is a system in place that will cater for building strong institutions rather than strong political parties that take over power and capture the state.
Thank you, guys. If I could add to that just a few comments. I've worked in many places in the world, and I can assure you that the incidence of corruption is not confined to the African continent. On the contrary, some of the places that I've worked in the Middle and Far East can teach us many, many lessons. on our continent. Secondly, more fundamentally, democracy is a messy process. Democracy is not neat and tidy and clean. It happens to be the only act in town. It's the only form of control, management of a state that actually lasts. But it is messy because it's run by human beings, and human beings, notwithstanding the fact that we are the reasoning animal, are also the stealing animal. It's inherent in human nature. Constitutions such as ours are designed to counter that as best we can. I watch you, you watch me, I'm a judge, I watch the politician watches the civil servant watches the judges, and that's how it's supposed to work. But ultimately, in this country, our real strength is not in the Constitution alone. The Constitution is an essential part, yes, but our Constitution does not work because it's a good Constitution. To the extent that it works because people make it work. The political will to restore our country to the dreams and ideals of the new constitution will depend upon people like this, people who come early on a Monday morning because they're concerned about the country. It's the political will of the right-minded people that makes the Constitution work, not the other way around. Enough pontificating. Next question. Here. Second, first here. Oh. Over here, please.
Hello.
Okay.
I'm from the United States, and I wonder if the two of you could come to my country and expose the corruption there.
Sorry.
So my question has to do with what I see as kind of increasing authoritarianism, and the fact that many of the leaders in the world are very suspect and are kind of colluding to crush independent journalism, and I'm wondering, with the growth of authoritarianism and the weakening of institutions, whether you are finding your jobs more challenging, and what you consider will be some of the obstacles in the future to the work that you do.
You guys, either of you want to respond to that?
Should we take another question? Or?
No, you
okay.
First.
Okay, look, just in our context, so I don't know how acquainted you are with our country's politics. Authoritarianism has been a long part of our country's history, you know, through colonial and apartheid years. And then we had kind of a Prague Spring for 10 years after 94, where the constitution was celebrated and lived, and there was even in the media and our own industry, you know, the media was celebrated in doing its job. And then a number of things happened. We can debate this for days, but you had something like the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, that broke away from the ANC, the young leaders from the governing ANC party, to form this very radical party. In reaction, they say, to the lack of economic empowerment of black people. Now, just over the past few months, this party has threatened journalists, has threatened myself, has threatened specifically women journalists as well from stages. People have received death threats. So I think that you know, what's happening internationally is definitely having an impact on us. The attacks by social media, the use of Twitter bots and fake news to target specific journalists who focus on specific investigations. There's specifically one journalist, Poli van Wyk from the Daily Maverick, who has investigated corruption by this political party, the EFF, through a mutual bank called VBS, and she was personally targeted and harassed in the most horrific ways for doing a job. So certainly I am feeling that in the past 2 years. I'm feeling that the screws are turned on to us again, that there's increasing amount of threats now with the proliferation of fake news and Twitter bots as well. But again, you know, we look to our institutions, we stand together as an industry, we go to court, we have taken this party to court now, we are in the Equality Court in the next month or two, we are suing them for defamation and hate speech. So we have these institutions, we have to use them.
Over here, thank you.
Yeah, to some extent, I want to add on to the previous question. Are we living in a better world in Angola and South Africa than 10 years ago, or in a worse world?
It depends on who is enjoying that life and who is on the wrong side of it. But I think in general, for people, let me give you the example of Angola. There is more freedom now, and there is less food. But it's not the consequence of having a new president. It's because for years, you had a government that was just plundering the country. And of course, with new freedom, people are becoming more demanding, you know, because they want better conditions of living, and that's how it should be. But how long will it take for people to see those benefits on their table? That's the pressure we have at the moment. But things are better off in a sense that, and it's too early to say because we've only had 2 years of a new president, less than 2 years. And it's still the same ruling party. And so some of the bad guys from the previous regime are still in government. And the judges are the same. The whole system essentially is just the same with the whole regime with a new face. So it's not about really being better off now and comparing, but ensuring that we can do our bidding so that in the next 5-10 years we have a better country, definitely, and that there is no sliding back.
He spoke about Angola, but I think he could have spoken about South Africa just as well. Look, I think for us who are able to sit here this morning, you know, life is harder now. But it's always been hard for the poor. So if you speak to a unemployed woman who lives in Khayelitsha, I don't know if she's going to tell you it's better now than 10 or 20 years ago even. Let's look at some of the instruments. So 10 years ago, we had economic growth in this country under Thabo Mbeki, just before the ANC kicked him out, in what was now, I think history will judge, a disastrous move. I remember a time when we had 7%. We spoke about 7% economic growth. Now we're talking about 0.7%, if we're lucky. You know, so I agree. I can agree with the sentiment of a lost decade in South Africa. I think we have lost great people in our institutions of law enforcement, at SARS, at the NPA, at the police. We have lost amazing capacity in our private sector. People who've left the country. We have lost people in politics. So I think the ANC under Ramaphosa is trying to reinvent itself, still surrounded by that group of so-called bad guys. But I always ask myself, and I get asked this question a lot these days, you know, should we vote for Ramaphosa? What is the difference between the ANC? Can the ANC change? What is the alternative? You know, what is the alternative? Is there an alternative government in the waiting? Is there another party that you really think can step in to be the government tomorrow? And I mean, I think we're going to have to ponder this question before we decide who to vote to on the 8th of May.
I'm going to make a fortune because I'm going to sell clothes pegs that are soft and pincers, so that you could pinch your nose when you vote on the 8th of May. One more question only.
I have two questions, one to the journalists and then one to yourself, Judge. To the journalists, I want to ask, who do you want to react whenever you expose something new? And I just quickly want to remind you of a discussion between Hafaji and the late Chris Lowe one evening at the philosophy cafe that I attended, where she said she was worrying for days on end whether she should have something in her newspaper then and worry And then she decides to publish it, and then there's no reaction whatsoever. So my question to you, do you want the public to react or the legal institutions? That's the one question. Second question to you, Judge. Is there a law against state capture? Or can one not call it economic treason?
Good question.
Which one of you speaks?
Let me go. I mean, I think, you know, we referred to this earlier. If your work doesn't deliver some tangible change in society, then what's the point? I mean, for me, it is great vindication, I guess, to see after 13, 14, 15 years of pursuing Bosasa, for example, that they've finally been liquidated, that they're closed down, that they're losing state tenders, that people are being arrested. Of course, the journalist in me jumps up immediately and says, well, why isn't everyone arrested? And what's going to happen to the poor people who used to just work there, who's now also losing their jobs? But I think, you know, that has to be at the heart of what we do, is the reaction by our readers, the people of this country. It can't be for any other reason.
Yeah. But in my experience, for years, I only counted on the patience that one day there would be a reaction. Because what corruption does when it becomes institutionalized is that people get numb, stop reacting.
Yes.
And the institutions do not work to respond to corruption because they have been captured by that very same, the same individuals who spread corruption around. And so for years I didn't expect that reaction, but I was sure that I was writing for the record, that one day someone would go back through my texts to find evidence against those individuals, or just as a history record for the next generation.
Yeah.
And to my surprise, some of the prosecutions taking place now in Angola are being based on articles on exposés I did many years ago. And that no one, for instance, one of my most critical exposés was read by less than 500 people. It was in 2010. And yet is the same exposé that caused most trouble legally for some individuals and brought up cases in Portugal and other jurisdictions and became quite important for companies, governments, and others to really have a hard look at what was happening in Angola in terms of corruption. So I think the main expectation is just to do the job right and ensure that someday someone will pick it up and run with it. That's what has been. But of course, we expect a reaction from the public, a reaction from the legal authorities, and it has to go both ways for it to have a real impact.
As far as the question is concerned, whether there isn't a law against state capture, there are multiple laws against state capture, both in the ordinary private sector criminal justice system, against theft, against corruption, against defeating the ends of justice. There are, at the same time, at the constitutional level, prohibitions against the abuse of power. The Constitution is perfectly clear on the duties and the obligations of each of the wielders of public power. But it's not in laws that we will be kept honest. It's in the minds and the hearts of people. So that you cannot come to a commission of inquiry 15 years later and say how shocked you were 15 years ago when you heard that there was state capture to the extent that a private company knew who was going to be the next minister before the minister himself had been told by the president. It's the oath of office of honest people that would prevent state capture. It's the doing of your duty by the policeman on the beat and the teacher in the classroom and the judge on the bench and the politician in parliament and the president in the union buildings that will prevent state capture. Thank you. Closing thought from each one of you in turn.
I'm not going to say anything after that. Thank you, Judge.
I'm not going to say anything either. Thank you very much for
Thank you.